The Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. I am Mildred Menlo, and this is my partner, Ruth Weiner. And we are anxious to get some pertinent information from you. We have naturally read the biographical sketches of you, but they are, for what we want, they are a little superfluous. We want more detailed information that we feel that you can give to us, background, etc. And so we will start by saying to you, we are interviewing Dr. Abraham Tversky. Rabbi, would you tell us something about your early background, where you came from, where your family came from, about your parents, your family?
Okay. My father was rabbi in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, came to Milwaukee in 1927, originally was Russian-born, the descendant of a long, long, long line of rabbis, probably as far back as one can remember. Himself the son of a Hasidic rabbi in Russia, as were his father before him, until the beginning of the Hasidic movement somewhere in the 17th century. Mother was from Galicia, near Krakow, city called Bobov, B-O-B-O-V. The reason I spelled that out, the significance of that is that one of the major Hasidic groups today is headed by her brother, my uncle, the rabbi of Bobov, who is a Hasidic rabbi. So she comes also from a long lineage of Hasidic rabbis, and incidentally father and mother were second cousins, so there's a lot of common family tree.
Could you give us the names of your father and mother?
Father was Jacob Tversky. Mother's maiden name was Leah Halberstam, H-A-L-B-E-R-S-T-A-M. And they emigrated to the United States, and as I mentioned, in the 1920s. Milwaukee had a fair amount of landslide of my father's, and somehow or other there was contact made, and he chose to settle in Milwaukee, and he stayed there for the next.
Did your parents bring any children with them?
My two oldest brothers were born in Poland.
What were their names?
The oldest was Shlomo. He died about 4 years ago. He was a Hasidic rabbi in Denver. The next one of the family is Motel, M-O-T-E-L. He is a certified CPA who lives in New York, and there he's about 6 years older than I am. And I was the first American-born product. I was
and what other children?
In Milwaukee. And then there was a set of twins who are 8 years younger than me, Michael and Aaron. Michael is a rabbi in Milwaukee who is now filling father's position. And Aaron is currently professor of law at Brooklyn Law College.
You and your wife came here.
Excuse
me. I mean, your parents came here with these children. Then you were married in Milwaukee?
I was married when I still lived in Milwaukee. I moved here several years after marriage. I was married in 1952, and I moved to Pittsburgh in 60.
Where did you get your earliest education, and what was it?
My earliest education came, first of all, I attended public school. In those days, there were no day schools, certainly in Milwaukee. But we had I had a tutor, and my formal early Jewish training was with a tutor who I saw every day after, who saw me every day after school. There was a great deal of education that I absorbed from the environment in the home. Incidentally, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Generation to Generation. That is a book I wrote describing a great deal of what the environment was like in my father's home, and also some rather interesting tales that have been handed, stories that have been handed down from generation to generation.
We'll read it.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of material that you might be able to pick up, mm-hmm. background material in that book. So my early Jewish education, till a little after bar mitzvah, was with a tutor because there was no day school in Milwaukee. And then at about age 14, I went to the yeshiva in Chicago, which was at that time known as the Hebrew Theological College. Stayed there for several years, then at about age 17 went down to New York for a year, and then came back to Chicago. So most of my Hebrew education was in Chicago. Then in 1951, I was ordained as a rabbi and became the assistant rabbi to my father in Milwaukee. Stayed in the active rabbinate full time for 4 years. Began to feel that I did not really like what I saw at that time was the role of the rabbi. And so I went to medical school. And what disappointed me at that time was in the 1950s was when psychiatry and psychology got its major spurt. Following World War II, there was a great deal of interest in the traumatic neuroses with the soldiers and whatever. And for whatever other reasons, psychiatry and psychology took a tremendous spurt. And psychoanalysis, particularly Freudian psychoanalysis, was such that anybody who was anybody was in analysis. You know, and it was not a stigma to be seen, it was a badge of honor to be seen by psychiatrists. I had grown up, as I wrote in my book, in the shadow of a very great father, and I liked what he was doing. He was not only the rabbi in the formal sense of the word, but he was arbiter, judge, marriage counselor, anything and everything to all people. He received a citation from the judiciary and from the state legislature, and it was a rather common thing when the judges were stuck with a very, very difficult litigation that they would say, well, go to Twersky and see if he can work it out. And things were worked out in my dad's office, my dad's study, that defied settlement in courts. And he had this uncanny capacity of relating with people and getting people to compromise on whatever the problem was. A great deal of marital counseling went on in the tall hours of the night. And I was a kid and I absorbed this all. And I liked what he was doing and I was going to be like him. Well, I was ordained in 1951 and I came in to be his assistant rabbi. And lo and behold, nobody was looking for me to do the kinds of things that they were turning to my father. Well, maybe this could have been because I was wet behind the ears, and who's going to ask advice of a 21-year-old snot, right? But that wasn't it. That I could have survived that because my age was improving every day, you know? I was getting older every day.
Time cures.
Yeah, time cures. That's one that time cures. But what was evident to me was that given the strong advent of psychiatry and psychology as the way to solve and deal with problems, that I saw people not going to the rabbi, certainly not this generation, and my father's generation maybe, but my generation was not going to turn to the rabbi for a solution of problems, because the new in thing was that you went to the professional psychologist or psychiatrist. And what I was essentially doing as a rabbi is I was doing a little bit of teaching in classes, but most of the time I was performing rituals. I was leading the services, and I was doing funerals and weddings and bar mitzvahs and all that kind of stuff. And I saw that if this is what the new trend is, I will not be a rabbi like my father was in terms of being a counselor and a person and a confidant. I'll be a performer of rituals. I didn't see my life as being a performer of rituals. And I felt that if what psychiatry is doing is what my father used to be doing, well, then that's where I'll go. So I went to medical school to become a psychiatrist to do what I wanted to do as a rabbi. And I think that since then there's been another swing of the pendulum and things have changed. Maybe it's because they've lost faith in psychiatry, but there has been a growth of pastoral counseling, and rabbis are now, at least some of them, are doing much more than conducting services. And maybe if things were in 1955 like they are today, maybe I would have stayed a rabbi. But be that as it may, things were not that way, and I did not like what I was doing as a rabbi, so I went out to medical school.
Don't you feel that your rabbinic background has been a tremendous plus in your particular area?
I don't think there's any question about that. Now, at times, I used to hold myself very, take myself very much to task, because I was married in 1952. We had two children when I went to medical school, and those 10 years were a struggle. I used to many times think, had I gone to medical school right out of college, right, I could have now had all this behind me and I could be earning instead of struggling for survival. So that's the way I used to think then. But it's become evident to me since then, since I'm a little more at ease, that these times that I spent not only in the education, but the little time that I spent in the practice was very valuable. And some of that has come through in another book that I wrote entitled Let Us Make Man, which has to do with how the themes and the ideas of Jewishness can help a person build a healthy self-esteem, healthy personality. So that just came out about a year ago.
Dr. Tversky, you and your wife went through these years, these traumatic years, when you were going to medical school. Tell me something about your wife.
My wife is the daughter of a rabbi. He was a rabbi in Brooklyn. She's one of two children. She was born in Danzig. Family left Danzig for Israel when she was about four. My father-in-law then, after several years, came to this country, wanted to bring the family over, but then the war broke out. And they did not get to come to the United States until 1944, so for about 10 years she lived in Israel. Graduated seminary and taught Hebrew courses, Bible study courses, and she still does. We met in 1952, as the custom was, by arrangement. Somebody thought that, somebody who knew me or somebody who knew her thought that this would be a very fine shidduch. And I guess that after my parents and her parents sort of checked each other out and found out that there was nothing incompatible, right, that we got the chance to meet. And we hit it off right from the first
I wish we could do that with our children.
Yeah, there's much to say for it. It has its drawbacks, but there's much to say for it. And thank God it's worked out to be a very happy marriage. We have four lovely children. My wife is a very, not sure that I know the right word to describe it, a very, very intuitive person. I value her intuition. I've learned to value her intuition much more above my appraisal. I mean, if we will meet a person, she will pick up immediately some things about that person and give me a gut feeling. And it always turns out to be right. It's an uncanny.
Yeah, that's an uncanny
intuition. She has continued to, of course, after raising a family, she's continued to do some teaching and teaches at the Yeshiva High School. She's an excellent homemaker and housekeeper. I don't believe that there is anyone in the country who can equal her coffee cake.
Oh, that's marvelous.
There's just no one who can come close to it.
Our next session, I want a piece.
There's only one tiny problem here, and that is that about 2 years ago, she was in New York for our grandchildren. We were in New York for our grandson's bris, and I left and she stayed a little longer. And walking along the sidewalk in New York, she fell and fractured her wrist. Ended up with a complication of the fracture and had to have surgery. And since then, because of the stiffness of the wrist, she has not kneaded dough. And she's just now, after 2 years, beginning to start kneading dough. Okay? And we have not yet, for 2 years, I have not had any coffee cake.
Needs a food processor.
He's got a food processor, but it doesn't. It's not the same.
No, I know.
He's got the dough hook, and she does break bread occasionally, but it's still not the same as she has to have me yet.
And that takes a lot of.
Yeah, but she's getting right. She says she's getting back to it, so.
Doctor, you speak in such glowing terms about your wife, and obviously it's a magnificent companionship that has grown between you. Isn't this a little bit unusual for a man of your background, for example, in the Hasidic families? Do women come to the fore as much as your wife has?
Well, probably today more so than before. Women came to the... Maybe women didn't come to the fore as much because of the whole social structure of where women were socially. And it was accentuated, I think, in the Jewish world. Right? But even in the non-Jewish world, it was still a male-dominated world. And, so women sometimes pulled the strings. There were the power behind the throne, that kind of thing. But there are many women who were very, very highly appreciated for their enormous talents. And some of the Hasidic lore is replete with women who made their contribution, although they had to do it there because of the enormous emphasis on modesty. Women had to do it in very, very serene, kind of sedate fashion. Without making too much public appearance. And more recently, since I became interested in addiction, past 15 years or so, and even more recently than that, since I became interested and very much involved with community awareness of the problems of addiction among Jews, which has been neglected, and have been going to gatherings for spiritual retreats for recovering Jewish alcoholics, addicts, and their family members. My wife goes with me on all of these, and I think that they really want her presence there more than mine.
Very important.
She's become the therapist that they... that they look forward to, and she gets calls very often that will keep her for an hour or so on the phone.
And it's marvelous the way you accept it.
Well,
and are pleased with it.
She's been tremendous in her intuition and her innate skills, and without any formal training, it's just been enormously helpful.
Tell us about your children.
3 boys and a girl. The oldest is... I've got to think I was married in 52, so he was born in 53, right? Which makes him 34. He is
What is his name, please?
Isaac. Isaac is married, lives in New York, has 6 children, 5 boys and a girl. He is a metallurgist. And all of our children have grown up with the whole Hasidic tradition and Hasidic practice. Son number 2, Ben Zion, is a year younger. He's 33. He is a PhD in psychology, and at the present time is in practice at Forbes Health Center. Son number 3 is not married. He is 30, and he is an attorney with a firm in New York. And daughter, Shlomo. Daughter, Sarah, is divorced. She lives locally. She has 3 children. And she is now, she just graduated nursing and is working at Presbyterian on the liver transplant.
Hmm. What sort of training did she have?
She went to day school. Went to seminary in Cleveland, and then started nursing school. Then she interrupted nursing school for the marriage, and then marriage failed. She went back to nursing school and graduated just last year.
That is rather a blow in Hasidic tradition.
Yeah, first of all, it's always a blow. It's a blow in Hasidic tradition, but for some reasons unknown, the incidence of divorce in Hasidic families, which was virtually unheard of as recently as 30 years ago, is now unfortunately very high. And I don't know what all the reasons for that are. There are probably a multiplicity of them. But it's no longer the unheard of thing. And it also means that marriages that years ago were people that were forced to stay together because there was no such thing as divorce. And maybe a lot of people were made miserable, and that their children were made miserable by unworkable marriages, that today that no longer happens. I don't know that we have a greater incidence of unhappy marriages. I think that what we're having a greater incidence of unhappy marriages is dissolving, whereas years ago they just stuck together. I wrote in the book Generation to Generation about a couple who I roomed with in Chicago back in the 1940s. They had been married 50 years, and I think that ultimately when whoever it was died first, they had been married probably 60 years or more by then. There wasn't one day that she did not curse him out. And that had been so, for anybody who knew them, that had been so since day one. I think that he died first, and they had 5th generation grandchildren that they see. In other words, they had great grandchildren, enormously large family, they enjoyed the family immensely, but they fought like cat and dogs for 60 years. I don't know that a marriage like that would have survived today. I don't know whether it's good that it survived or was that survived, but it was just the social thing that, well, why didn't they divorce? For the same reasons that elephants don't fly, you know?
That was true generally in that generation.
Yeah. I don't know if it was better or worse, but that's the fact.
In today's generation, Doctor, what do you think of background education for the average Jewish child?
What, do you want to find background?
For example, children go to school. Have you a set idea of how this education should proceed?
Well, of course, I've got some of my own biases. First of all, I strongly believe in identity. I think that a person should know who they are, who he or she is. And that I think that a Jew should know that he is a Jew or that she is a Jew and what it means. And simply for that reason itself, I believe that intensely in the day school system rather than in public schools. I think that in terms of actual knowledge of secular subjects in the 3 R's and so forth, all of the day schools have exceeded the standards that the public schools have. And I think that a first-rate quality education can be achieved in a day school. And the advantage of the day school is that they have a adequate time to spend on teaching Jewish subjects and giving the child a Jewish identity. Now, as far as relating to others, I think that the idea that some people say, well, you have to mix with others to be able to relate to them. I think that you have to be yourself first before you can relate to others. I've seen too many people relating to others who don't know who they are themselves. In terms of having an intense Jewish identity being some sort of an obstacle to making an adjustment to a secular society, I take myself as an example. I don't know that one could appear externally more obviously Jewish, right? By, you know, my dress and garb and whatever else. I have gone to countless numbers of banquets, meetings, whatever. Don't eat together, don't drink together. There are very clear differences between me and my peers or friends or whatever who are non-Jewish. That hasn't in any way impaired my going to Marquette University, which was a Jesuit school, my ending up as 20 years clinical director of the Department of Psychiatry at a Catholic hospital.
We were going to get to that in
right.
question.
So, the idea that, but if you're going to be exceedingly Jewish, that's going to set up all kinds of barriers. Well, the only barrier that will set up is the barrier that I think is desirable, and that's the barrier against assimilation. And I think that people who grow up intensely Jewish are less apt to intermarry and to dilute the Jewishness. I see intermarriage as being one of the threats that ultimately could mean the demise of Jewishness. So background education, I think, should be a very thorough education in all areas, and you really don't have to have it at the expense of anything, but should also have a very strong Jewish content and environment.
What are your involvements in the community today, Doctor? Apart from your professional?
Well, I don't know that there's as much time as I'd like for involvement. There's a bunch of things that happen in the community because of my professional involvements. But many things that involve the current problems that are so pressing, which are problems of alcoholism and drug addiction in many ways, you know, as it involves industry, as it involves the Department of Corrections, as it involves education, whatever. I've almost got a hand in almost in anything simply because of my professional involvement with alcohol and drugs. Time is really cut in seriously to being able, I'm probably on the board of a couple of places that I don't know of, because I have not been able to make board meetings. I tried to stay involved with the yeshiva school, which has been very close because that's where my kids went to their education, and any school that needs support, I want to give support. Try to stay involved with the Kollel, which is the Institute for Higher Talmudic Learning. Try to stay involved with the little place where I daven at, which is Lubavitch Center, whatever. But there's little else to get involved with that I would like to, simply time-wise. I'm for years now, always been under a deadline of getting something or else, something or other, into publication, as is right now. And there's another article sitting there that has to get out within a couple of days. So by the time I come home, I try to sit down and do some writing, and that doesn't work because I fall asleep. And so instead of, so when I wake up, I said, look, there's no time to write now. I'll try and review some of the things that I did yesterday and do a little editing. And that doesn't last forever because as I grow older, I get less and less energy. So I get up at 5 o'clock the next morning and do my hour and a half of writing in the morning. So.
You don't have too much time for, let me say, some cultural entertainment of any sort. You just can't make it.
Unfortunately, no.
End of side one, take one. Continued on side two.